Go ahead and get started here. My name is Elnor Saita. I'm going to be talking about privacy in modern cities as cities become more and more digital and more self-aware. There are a lot of different kinds of surveillance out there already that a modern city dweller interacts with. We've been watching people for a really long time, and every time we create a new type of media, we end up creating a new type of surveillance. This list is, necessarily kind of completely incomplete. There are far, far, far more types of surveillance than you really want to think about sometimes. To make this a little bit more real, let's kind of go through a bit of a narrative. So you wake up and you turn on the lights, and a smart electric meter notes the change in power use. And you make coffee, you check your webmail, your ISP screens and stores all the web traffic. You reply to an email, an intelligence agency stores that, and keyword matches the contents. Your mail provider analyzes the information and sells it to an ad company. You turn on your phone, and it registers its location with an emergency services database. The phone company also records it. The intelligence agency cross-references the two new SMSs that you got with the email that you sent earlier. You take a shower, and the gas and water meters note the usage. You get dressed and get on the subway to go to work. Along the way, you appear on cameras run by your landlord, the transit agency, several nearby merchants, the police, and the traffic agency. The time you swipe your card to enter the subway is stored along with your identity. While you wait on the platform, you get a call from your boss. The numbers, the time, and the duration are logged for law enforcement and billing. The phone company doesn't capture the voice data, but the camera you're standing under does, as does the company phone on the other end. The train arrives, and you walk by an air quality monitoring box as you get on, and then the transit agency tracks the train's movements while onboard cameras record you. As you walk out, the destination of your journey is noted on your Metro card, and separately, the turnstile increments the number of people leaving the station in this period. On the way to the office, in addition to passing through the vision of, a couple dozen other cameras, you stop to buy a croissant. You pay by credit card, and the transaction is recorded by the merchant, the credit card processor, the credit card company, and the issuing bank, the last three of whom all run it through fraud detection systems and then sell that data to marketers. Your mobile phone registers your changing location. You walk past a weather station. The signal from the mobile is briefly evaluated by an RF threat detection system run by a national security agency. A cab with its own video system, GPS tracker drives by, and plate and face recognition systems record who the driver is and what the car is. It backfires, which triggers all sorts of recording inside the cab, and then that gets picked up by a gunshot detecting microphone that evaluates that for a potential shot and throws it out as a false positive. The cab itself is logging speed data and engine data and acceleration, which can be used by the police or insurance companies if an accident happens. It drives over a temporary traffic load sensor, past a red light camera, and less obviously, past a chemical sniffer looking for explosive residue. You walk into the office through an alarm door, past a window with a glass break detector, and also a heat rise and smoke detector. You show up in another camera, and you swipe your badge to get in, which is logged. You log in to your workstation, which is logged. You load up a web page, which is checked by the corporate web filter. You've been awake less than 2 hours, and half a dozen government agencies and nearly three times as many private institutions have already recorded data about you. And this is completely normal. This happens every single day, and we don't notice it. So now that we have some idea of what the scope of the issue is and just how pervasive this is, let's take a step back and look at some of the structural issues around surveillance to kind of better understand the position of this sort of surveillance within a larger socioeconomic frame. One of the distinct complications of surveillance work is the same property of digital information that makes it a fundamentally more useful medium for its intended purpose, namely the fact that all of this surveillance data can be very simply and easily retransmitted and aggregated. The physical installation of sensors is visible and fairly obvious, but once those sensors exist, repurposing the data can be done in a much less visible manner. For instance, when a municipality decides to install a camera system, they may at first present it as a traffic camera, theoretically only placed to watch for, traffic accidents, to view traffic levels, that sort of thing. However, those same cameras very often get shifted over to general police use. This has been true from the very first CCTV installations in Munich in 1958, which were billed as traffic cameras for about the first 2 years. The pattern repeats for a lot of different technologies. Mobile phone location tracking, at least in the US, was originally billed as a reporting feature for integrating with the 911 emergency call system so that operators there could know where you were calling from, because this was becoming an increasing problem of them getting calls that they couldn't locate. However, the police and the intelligence agencies really quickly adopted this. Last year, one telecommunication reported more than 8 million location data requests, not including 911 calls, intelligence agency operations, or civil lawsuits. That's just one telco. That's maybe one location request for every 10 subscribers, maybe less, or maybe more. So the biggest form of secondary use involves buying, selling, and sharing data. This is a fundamental feature of modern consumer society. The very idea of a credit rating is based on companies sharing financial information with each other through mediating agencies, the rating agencies, both for consumers and enterprises. You literally can't have a modern consumer society without this kind of data sharing at some level. The same thing happens now with other less clear-cut information, like all the results of data profiling done by marketing agencies. An amazing amount of information is included in these profiles, down to mood data reported by voice stress analysis systems built into interactive voice response systems. Your profile with some data clearinghouse may literally say, the last time you were on the phone with your credit card agency, you sounded stressed, and they'll use this to sell you services or to do whatever. In a lot of the world, these data clearinghouses are largely unregulated. Similar things exist within the state. In the past 10 years or so, many large interagency databases have been built, and they collect all sorts of information, not just about convicted criminals. National intelligence agencies have also taken to buying the civilian clearinghouse data, as they can't collect all of that on their own, and even if they had the capability to, this lets them get around a lot of rules around who they are and are not allowed to watch. It also means that they get data that hasn't been properly vetted, that was never intended for this kind of evidence. You know, it was like the voice stress analysis stuff is mostly intended for call routing. So if you sound really stressed, they send you to a customer service agent quicker. But it's gotten captured and moved on. This kind of data sale and the entire second use system are driven by a lot of different things, among them the expense of gathering data. Once a city has spent millions of dollars on a CCTV system, there's an immense pressure on them to make sure that they're getting the most out of that investment. And this leads to second uses of that data being set up that may not have very much direct benefit, but that they show that the city is making the best use of that investment. They can point to, like, oh, well, we're not just getting this one use, we've got all this other stuff we're doing with this data, and that helps them justify it, even if the residents of that city may not actually want any of those secondary uses. A similar pressure exists in the commercial world, where companies that have accumulated data for legitimate primary business reasons look for ways to defray the cost of that data collection. The same things end up causing these sort of public-private partnerships, where you have like some private CCTV cameras roped into a public surveillance network, you know, that kind of sharing. The same pressures end up being behind a lot of the cases where the government uses surveillance abusively. It's really rare that a government sets out to build a system just to track political dissidents. Like, that isn't the kind of thing that normally has money spent on it. But it's a pretty regular occurrence that when systems are built for some theoretically legal purpose, whether it's a wiretap system that doesn't have sufficient safeguards, or it's a database that's only intended to track known criminals, those get used to gather intelligence on and to track and harass dissidents and both personal and political enemies. The more global a system like this is, the reach of it is, the more damage it can cause, and the more easily data can flow through this system, which is to say, for the purposes of the people who are using it, the more efficient of a system it is, the harder it is to ensure that appropriate controls are placed at all levels. One example here is there was a credentialing system which was going to be built in the UK. I don't know if it ever got finished or if it got canceled, for anyone who was going to be working with kids anywhere. And they would all have full background checks and everything else pushed into this system, which would then be available to anyone else who worked with kids, any police officer, like public safety. You know, hundreds of thousands of people were going to have access to complete background checks and credit histories on anybody who wanted to come into contact with kids in any way. You know, tell me that's not going to get abused. So the progress of the technology of surveillance is directly at odds with the prevention of abuse, even assuming the first purposes of that surveillance are perfectly reasonable. They're generally not, but even if they were. So a large class of initiatives which end up invading people's privacy are based on making data that's already stored or is at least semi-publicly available, digitally available. The argument that's presented here is, well, there's no actual change in how much privacy someone has when this happens. But that's pretty obviously functionally false. Privacy isn't an absolute binary function. It's a gradation across different types of information, different amounts of data available, and different degrees of difficulty of access. Changing any of those variables has an immediate effect and a concrete effect on individual privacy. This alone, assuming that we consider invading privacy to be, you know, a fundamentally evil act, puts all of Google's lies about not being evil, you know, to lie, because they have done more than any other company to reduce the difficulty of getting access to information, any information, regardless of whether there's PII or whatever in there, you know, there's personally identifiable information. They consider that not their problem. They consider, well, it's publicly available anyway, you know, we're not doing anything bad. Aggregation and data profiling make things even more complicated. When companies or agencies make an effort to collect large swaths of information, both public sources and private ones, and create a profile out of it, they can learn far more than one might expect. Faint traces of information can be really statistically telling, and while they're not always accurate, they can be surprisingly so. So for instance, you know, they start getting records that, oh, so-and-so is calling their credit card agency and they sound really stressed. Well, maybe they lost their job. You know, I mean, they have no actual information to say that, but if they look that, oh yeah, 95% of the time when we see this pattern of behavior changes, that's what happens, they have that information effectively, and they'll note that they have that information. And maybe if you're lucky, they'll note the certainty at which they have that information, but they probably don't. Economies of scale help this process a lot. To build a system like this to investigate one person would be horrendously inefficient. But if you're investigating a couple hundred million people, it's really cheap. It's a sound investment. The differences in economies of scale are one of the reasons that the future where we all go along with having no privacy because everyone has no privacy, so the playing ground is even, it's fundamentally a non-starter. It doesn't result in equality because the different resources that different agencies and different groups have create a power dynamic in who can know what. The result of this data profiling, of this aggregation, is not a public record. So therefore, they do have information that we can't generate because we can't necessarily buy those databases, even if we had the money. Sometimes they're restricted in various ways. They won't enter into a trade agreement. You know, it doesn't end up actually being an even playing field. Furthermore, organizational privacy and personal privacy aren't the same thing. Corporations can be hurt monetarily, but this doesn't cause psychological harm to a corporation. You know, a corporation doesn't feel violated and have to go to a therapist because someone published their trade secrets. It just doesn't work that way. The legal system is also very good at taking care of the kind of privacy that companies care about. They've done a lot of very extensive and very expensive lobbying around patents and trademarks and copyrights and trade secrets, so their privacy gets taken care of. So now that we understand a bit more about why surveillance can be complicated, let's look a bit more in detail at how it can affect people. We mostly think of surveillance as being a negative thing, but there are actually a lot of ways that it can be very, very good, depending on who you are and what your relation to that surveillance is. Because the effects of any individual type of surveillance system can be really complex, we're just going to look at specific facets of different systems. Some of the real-world implementations of these systems have all sorts of other effects, have all sorts of problems, but that's not what we're focusing on. We're looking just mostly at primary uses, but just at those specific facets. So there are a number of different kinds of surveillance systems that purport to be lifesavers of one kind or another, and many of them actually are. One good example here is a wide variety of medical monitors that the medical community is developing and implanting, especially pacemakers. Just getting full-time EKG data can be really useful, even when that data is only offloaded in batches. But if you have a pacemaker that can monitor your heartbeat and alert doctors and paramedics in real time, immediately in the case of a cardiac event, you have a massive advantage in terms of getting help and literally surviving. Some other similar examples are fall detection and alerting systems for the elderly or for solitary industrial workers, so that, you know, if somebody trips and, you know, falls down on a factory floor when they're working late at night and there's no one nearby, you know, on-site medical staff, whatever, can be informed. A lot of these systems are really expensive. Another example is various car safety systems that can remotely disable the vehicle or monitor and, again, summon police and paramedics in the event of an accident. Manufacturers package these kinds of systems into luxury automobiles. They're marketed to large enterprises, or they require really good insurance or private medical care. These are luxury surveillance. One of the largest categories of modern surveillance is what's done for marketing purposes. Is this good for the person being marketed to? I mean, it's a complicated question. To some extent, corporations do market profiling so they can manipulate the subject into spending money on something regardless of their prior desires. There's also an element, however, of showing the subject things that they're most likely to want. To some degree, this can be seen as a service. You know, you're ensuring that the subject is aware of things that meet their desires. This is, of course, incomplete because they're also trying to manipulate and create that desire. This communication isn't a one-way street, though. The companies that employ marketing profilers want to know what will sell. As one moves further and further up the scale of purchases in terms of price, the potential pool of buyers shrinks. At the high end, each individual in that pool has an increasingly direct say on what products they want to see made. It's still a form of surveillance, but it eventually becomes sort of conversational in an odd way, a sort of a mass negotiation at this very rarefied level of consumption. Even once data has been captured by a system, it's not necessarily treated the same way for everyone. Many record systems literally contain specific features designed to protect some people's privacy more than others. We know this, among other reasons, because people are regularly fired for peeking where they shouldn't, at the medical records and the tax returns and the private police reports, among other things, of the rich and the famous. In the case of private organizations, it's easier to explain why this is happening. The rich are in a position to simply demand this kind of treatment from anyone they want to do business with and receive it. Indeed, having someone on your staff, if you have a sufficient amount of money, just to kind of hunt down and remove or have sealed unwanted information that you don't want out there is probably worthwhile. I mean, I know Scott McNeely has made a whole lot of noise. He was one of the original people saying, oh yeah, privacy is dead. And then when he had personal records published online, you know, lawsuits suddenly started coming up and he had this phalanx of lawyers trying to get rid of it. Privacy is only dead if you don't have the money to keep it on life support. The case of state records is even more troubling, though. The state should be blind to this kind of thing. There is no reason that the state should say, oh, you appeared on TV last week, so we'll seal your tax records and fire anyone who looks at them. There's no reason for that, but they do it. One of the more common forms of non-marketing economic surveillance is fraud detection for credit cards and debit cards and checks and ACH. It's another form of surveillance which is working explicitly in the favor of the user, as their interests are mostly aligned, at least here, with those of the bank. Of course, to be eligible for this kind of surveillance, you have to have a credit card and you have to use it for all your transactions. If you have the money, you can even pay to be more closely protected, which is to say more heavily watched. If you have an American Express Centurion card, they, you know, will assign specific people to just sort of keep track of what's going on. You have to spend $1 million a year to keep that card, but, you know, maybe it's worth it. There are a few categories of surveillance that seem to help everyone fairly equally, like environmental surveillance, especially things like air and water quality testing. Even as these kinds of sensors become more ubiquitous, though, their distribution is not necessarily even. Comprehensive environmental quality testing isn't cheap, and different cities can afford it at different levels just because of the amount of money that they have in their tax bases. Even within cities, though, this isn't necessarily deployed evenly. Denser areas are easier to test, and among those dense areas, The city may monitor those areas with the more monetary or more social capital more tightly, especially if those areas then go out and decide to supplement public testing with private testing. This is especially notable in things like home lead testing and asbestos testing for, you know, lead paint or, you know, construction from the 60s. The same kind of logic applies to traffic counting systems that are used to measure road repair needs and determine funding. In theory, all of those systems should get spread equally across a given district by the transit agency, but any system like this is subject to social pressures. You know, if you have a bunch of people who have the free time, and it's like, oh, there's a pothole on my street. I want that fixed. I'm going to, you know, go call up my friend who knows somebody at the transit agency and have them put a sensor in here. And yeah, sure, it shows there's more traffic here, and then that means someone else's street doesn't get watched. There are other cases where corporate or state interests aren't aligned with the people, though, such as with corporate environmental liability, where all of a sudden it becomes much harder as a private individual to get this kind of testing. Or when the city of New York banned private air quality testing in the entire city in the aftermath of the 2001 attacks, because there were still all these debates raging over the long-term effects of dust from the collapsed buildings in Lower Manhattan, and there was all of this stuff about, oh, is the city liable for this stuff? So they actually banned private deployment of air quality monitors. Another category of surveillance, which is kind of interesting, are alarm systems, or really this kind of entire gamut of personal protection systems. You can have your house and your car and your laptop and your mobile phone and your person all watched for an appropriate fee. How good these services are, how much good they'll do you, varies by a lot of things, but among them, you know, most strongly by how much you want to pay. You can get a simple alarm system that calls the police after the fact at one price. You can get a silent alarm with cameras at another price. You can get private armed response at a third price. You can have on-site guards at another price. Surveillance most strongly benefits those people who pay for it. In fact, this kind of thing is often a race to the bottom. You know, the one house on the block that doesn't have a private armed response team is the one that gets robbed, and everyone else lives in paramilitary camps with glass on the walls. I'm not actually kidding about this. If you go to LA and you drive down Sunset Boulevard, every single house has these glass-topped walls out front, and they have private armed response services where you get goons showing up with submachine guns when your alarm goes off. Not cops, you know, a private police force. So only a small fraction of the surveillance in a modern city is actually about surveillance to stop crime, but this is the main thing that people think of when they think about surveillance in the city. You know, CCTV cameras mounted on rooftops or overlooking back alleys or places where people congregate, especially young people. The ring of steel around the city of London, the same thing that's being built and rebuilt around Lower Manhattan, airport security scanners, all of that kind of stuff. So the efficacy of these cameras, especially ones which aren't monitored live and actually stopping crime, is in severe doubt. Many studies, especially some done in the UK where they've had a reasonably long history of dense surveillance use, have shown little or no real effect on either crime or terrorism. You know, it's very apparent now that cameras don't stop terrorists. Terrorists don't care. Police and municipalities are now turning to this argument to support the installation of smarter network-connected cameras at additional expense. This is a form of the so-called soft infrastructure or networked infrastructure that's being built into cities now. These will theoretically allow police to monitor all of these cameras in real time and intervene in real time. Of course, there's no evidence to show that spending hundreds of millions of dollars on these systems will actually help, let alone that they will help more than other less invasive tactics. So regardless of their usage, what's interesting from our perspective is the social divisions that these cameras create, or rather the divisions that they reproduce and that they highlight in society. The camera creates three explicit social roles in its interaction. It divides the watcher from the watched and the bystanders. The distinction between the last two categories is especially interesting. Surveillance cameras installed for security are not intended to catalog all actions. They're intended to capture the subset of actions that the watcher deems interesting. This determines things like their placement, et cetera, when they're looked at, you know, when they're operated. And, you know, so they select then out of the subset of people who pass through the frame those that are actual or merely likely committers of these actions, you know, the potential offenders. And this is a selection, you know, it's a selection that's done by the watcher, but it can be seen as being done by the entire surveillance system. When these cameras are intended to prevent crimes against people, as opposed to crimes against property, which is more typical in private, non-state-run cameras, the bystanders are the protected class, which creates an even more stark opposition. For the watched, the cameras represent hostility and suspicion. For the protected, they represent security and freedom from trouble. For the watcher, they represent the ability to choose who is in which class and which incidents they wish to respond to and which incidents they wish to disappear. This is especially relevant in the case of police-run cameras observing police actions. In theory, the police in frame should belong to the protected class. I mean, the cameras are partially there for their benefit, but in fact, if nothing else due to fraternity with their fellow police officers, they belong to the watching class. They belong to the class of people who get to decide who is watched and which incidents are seen and which aren't, which is really, really dangerous. This is demonstrated nowhere better than on occasions where police brutality footage should have been captured by police-run cameras, but when the case comes to trial, somehow, we don't know where the footage is. It's not in the system anymore, sorry. Beyond this, we can note that the protected are without exception likely to belong to a higher socioeconomic stratum. Not only will the well-off be perceived in any given situation as less likely to be the offender, but they will spend more time in these watched areas. It's no accident that the most heavily watched areas in the world are the global financial markets. There are even in some cases that allow the privileged to avoid personal scrutiny while still benefiting from the scrutiny of others, whether through things like diplomatic privilege at borders, or the now defunct CLEAR system that allowed travelers in the US to avoid most of airport security if they paid a certain amount of money, or just by being driven into a private garage in your office building in a limo with tinted windows driven by an off-duty police officer who's probably armed. Another interesting note in this category is the collusion of surveillance technology in restricting speech in public-private spaces like shopping malls. Here, the division isn't simply between social categories, but between those who wish to express ideas inimical to the particular environment and those who either are okay with remaining silent or whose voice is in sympathy with management. As we've seen, the effects of surveillance can be both good and bad. Surveillance as an activity is very much an embodiment of the power structures of the societies that perform it. The technologies that implement it render the social structure in steel and glass and silicon and embed it literally increasingly into the fabric of our cities. We've seen a consistent pattern by which people with more money, more power, or more social status can either act to be watched less in bad ways and watched more in good ways, or by which it simply happens to them. Another reflection of the sort of ambient social privilege through which they move, quite often completely unaware. This shows no signs of stopping. On the contrary, many of the smart city initiatives that are attempting to push much of the beneficial intelligence of the new kind of soft infrastructure that's being installed into mobile devices, including fairly basic functions of the modern city like environmental monitoring, you know, things which are good surveillance. While the ideas are good, these devices are often expensive luxury gadgets, will continue to be expensive luxury gadgets, and availability is always going to propagate from the top down. So as our cities become more digitized and that digitization becomes more and more built into the fabric of the city, this pattern is going to keep repeating. So what can we do about all this? Both the growing surveillance state and the inequality in surveillance need to be addressed in equal measure. Hackers and makers are in a unique and fairly interesting place here. We have both the technical background and often the socio-political understanding to see the full breadth of the problem, and we have at least semi-organized community that can work together, albeit in this sort of, you know, modern distributed swarm sort of fashion. We're in some ways a very privileged group, and we're also occasionally a marginalized group, and that gives us an interesting position to speak out to people on both sides of the issue. There are four things, roughly, that we can do. Document the problem, raise awareness of it, work to change existing projects and subvert the system. In many ways, this is the same kind of catalog of tactics for any sort of social change, although the details are obviously different. As with any other issue, there are many existing networks of people working on different areas of the problem. Working with other people lets you get more work done. So the details of the ways that different groups watch us are often not public in like the actual concrete specificity. Certainly they're not aggregated. Helping to find and collate this sort of information is a basic first step for any kind of further work. This can be as simple as helping to make and update maps of where all the security cameras are in your neighborhood, or it can be more involved, whether that means doing background research on surveillance programs and filing Freedom of Information Acts or your local equivalents, or reverse engineering surveillance systems and documenting their capabilities and like when they're supposed to log things and that kind of thing. An interesting example of the latter happened recently in Seattle. There was a wrongful arrest case where a friend of mine who's a hacker was picked up by the police. The police weren't forthcoming in their video evidence during the trial. He went and did a whole bunch of digging and figured out that their surveillance management system in question is supposed to keep a secure, non-deniable log of any, you know, anything that happens with any piece of media. So he asked the police to back up their assertions that, that video is gone with the relevant log entries, and he got them. And then those log entries showed that, no, the video does actually exist. And he eventually did get access to the video and then is now working on making public what he found out about how that system works. This is a fairly widely deployed system, and most of the other equivalent systems work in similar ways. So now lawyers who end up in this kind of position of being told by the police that, oh, those tapes don't exist, can know, oh, okay, well, send me the logs to prove that they don't exist. And because a lot of these systems, you know, like a record must be kept for a certain amount of time, but then it'll get deleted on a space available basis or that kind of thing. And as soon as there's a request for it, of course, it has to be fixed and not get deleted anymore. So they can either prove that at least there was police wrongdoing if they did delete the request, if they did delete the video manually, and that may be, you know, grounds for a mistrial. But then they can also say, oh, no, you've still got that video. And this is removing an aspect of the police's power to choose when those tapes show up. And it's also, it's just kind of changing that whole equation around the power there. So it's not enough for us to understand that we're being watched and how we're being watched any more than it's enough for all of this information to exist in little fragments across our community. The rest of the world needs to understand too. We've been telling people around us and the public about computer security and online privacy for a long time. We've been telling people about privacy in the physical world in kind of isolated incidents, but it's time we start speaking more frequently and more directly to offline privacy as, you know, the offline and the online kind of merge over time, and as our actions in the city start becoming tracked more and more often. You know, it's also worth telling people that, you know, yeah, when you're watched by a video camera, it doesn't make you safer necessarily, but it does make the space more hostile to a lot of people, and it encourages a lot of different kinds of police harassment. So when these new surveillance systems get built and when legal structures that are passed to enable them get passed, this doesn't happen in a vacuum. A lot of this is the kind of the usual stuff of civic activism, you know, whether that means a protest or getting in contact with lawmakers or lawyers or raising the issue of surveillance at planning meetings and saying, no, you can't put a camera on the side of this building here because it overlooks this public space and that's a private, whatever the law ends up being, you know, whatever you can do. This doesn't have to be limited to state surveillance either. Talk to the people whose businesses you patronize and say, hey, why do you have that camera up there? You know that isn't going to actually stop robberies. You know that isn't keeping you safe. It's just hurting, you know, it's just making this place more hostile. So subverting the system is something we're really good at. It can take a whole lot of different forms. They can be pranks that show the futility or the ridiculousness of the surveillance culture. They can be practical tools for avoiding surveillance or countering this sort of power dynamic. In the former category are things like the Tor project for proxying content and fighting traffic analysis, and OTR for secure instant messaging. In the last part of this talk, I'm going to describe a new competition for a project that's in the latter category of changing that power balance. So the greatest power imbalance that happens in the sphere of surveillance exists between private citizens and the state, and this is most exacerbated when a citizen is attempting to take action against state violence. Police and military brutality are real. they're horrifying, and they're happening all over the world. The worst excesses happen when no one is watching. And even though surveillance tools are widely deployed throughout the world, there are a lot of countries where they will only ever act as a tool of oppression. In a lot of situations, there's no question whether or not you'll show up on video, and that if that video can be used to incriminate you, it will. This is especially true for large political demonstrations. However, if the state decides to suppress a demonstration, they often suppress the video of that demonstration too. They don't want the police showing up on camera when they go beat the hell out of a bunch of unarmed hippies. It's questionable at best if getting video out from places like Burma or Iran can make an immediate material difference in those kinds of situations, but at the very least it can, and it has, swayed public opinion. So even if there isn't a recourse to law, there is a function there. It's even more interesting when there is a recourse to law, where there's still significant corruption, but you can still say, oh, I can still actually bring a lawsuit. This is a lot of the world, both developed and developing. So the obvious way to fix this problem is to shoot your own video. You're not going to be able to install a citywide network of video cameras, but you don't need to as an individual. You just need a few cameras with a clear view right there when you need them. You can do that with a mobile, but shooting video, cheap camera, that kind of thing. But there are four problems. First, the person shooting the video is really easily identifiable in the moment. Which is kind of obviously undesirable. You really don't want to be the guy who's holding up the camera in front of the gang of riot cops. That's not a really comfortable position to be in. Second, these cameras produce horrible, horrible video. You have really crap line of sight when you're on the ground, and you're running away, and the camera's bouncing everywhere, and you can't see anything. Third, the video is generally stuck on the camera until you can upload it. This is starting to change, but it's only changing slowly. It generally relies on the cell network, which may be jammed or maybe down or who knows. And also, having potentially incriminating video on your camera can be just as bad as being seen shooting it. It doesn't necessarily matter if they knew who took it, if they can just get it off of something else. And there's no way to collate or manage the video online. There are plenty of generic ways to host the information, but a lot of those aren't designed for cross-reference between video, geolocating videos so that you can say, oh, this was this angle, and this is how it overlays on the street, and this is what was going on. It's also worth noting that every jurisdiction has slightly different rules of evidence that you have to follow if you want to use that video in court. Mobiles do have the advantage of a large existing installed base, but they're not necessarily the right tools for the job. So in the interest of kind of leveling the playing field a bit, I'm announcing a competition to build deployable video cameras, combination of off-the-shelf components, open hardware, and free software that can be deployed in an urban environment easily. There'll be three categories to compete in. UAV cameras that, you've got your remotely commanded helicopters, little model helicopters. You can stick a lightweight video camera on them, and then all of a sudden, you've got a nice camera that's hovering on the rooftop. You can move it around, whatever. Static cameras, whether it's like a camera attached to a sort of bolo so you can throw it over the wires like a pair of shoes, and then maybe it has a way to drop the camera down later. Or maybe it's just really cheap and it doesn't matter. And then software-only solutions to run on existing mobile phones to provide discrete live uploading and appropriate video management on the back end. So the goal of this competition is as much to spur work on these kind of devices and similar ones as it is to develop a field of immediately deployable solutions. The competition is open to everyone, but hackerspaces and similar groups are really especially encouraged to enter. This isn't that easy of a problem. It does take a team to develop a kind of a system like this. The only firm requirements are that everything developed specifically for the competition has to be released under open source and open hardware licenses, and the resulting system needs to be legal in its chosen jurisdiction. For example, in the US, that means you have to have radios that are compliant with FCC regulations and no ability to record audio because that gets you in trouble with the wiretap laws. There are going to be 8 criteria for judging. I'm not going to go into the details of scoring right now. This is just sort of to give you an idea of what we're looking at. All of that information will be on the competition website shortly. Two notes. Cost is a criteria for the competition, but it's expected that kind of the first generation of these things are going to be a bit more expensive than you're actually going to want to use in the field. Prices come down on this kind of stuff. Hardware gets cheaper. It gets easier to build these things. We learn, you don't actually need that part. You can swap it out for something else. That's fine, Also, teams are strongly encouraged to get in touch with groups that may actually be using these sorts of cameras in the field. and say, okay, well, hey, you've got this device, you know, give it a test run somewhere, you know, or what do you, you know, what would you like, you know, if, you know, how would you like a device to help get video out for you? What would be the most useful thing? If you have a group that you're working with, that kind of feedback will get taken into account both in the judging and both the involvement of the group and the feedback from the group will get taken account into the judging. So there'll be a preliminary evaluation of progress in about 6 months, hopefully right before the Congress this winter. And we'll see if the teams feel like they need more time to complete their work. That's the URL there, sldrc.com/project/deployable. The site right there right now is pretty minimal. The QR code is just the same as the site. So. Anyone have any questions? And that's the URL for the slides if you're interested. Thank you very much. Or did you have? Okay.
Yeah, I've got a little bit of a problem with all this privacy people saying that security cameras don't help fighting crimes, because I see the point that they don't prevent crimes, because if you are drunken and whatever and you want to beat the hell out of one guy, you don't think about security cameras. I get
sure.
That point. But I think for investigations, it's obviously that you can find out who was it, you know, who did it afterwards.
Actually, that's you'd think that, but that's what's really interesting. The guys in the UK did like a 10 or 15 year review of all of the places where they had cameras involved, where they had public records. And they showed very, very little actual use of the video in conviction. Basically, in maybe one, and I don't remember the numbers. I'd have to go look up the study again. I think it was published in the Journal of Surveillance and Society in maybe 2006 or 2007, that in only a very, very small number of cases did they get a conviction only through the use of video evidence. There were definitely some cases where like they had some other evidence and the video evidence maybe helped a little, but the number of cases which were actually solved through video evidence was really, really small. So that's actually, I mean, it's actually what's really kind of interesting is you would think intuitively that, oh yeah, it will help, but it actually doesn't make that much difference for investigations.
Yeah, just to add to that, a couple of years ago, you mentioned it, an internal memo from the London Metropolitan Police was leaked, and their internal memo showed that basically the effect of having sort of one camera for every two people living in London was hardly noticeable in either preventing or after the fact tracking down the perpetrators of crime. And it certainly had it in. The cost of having those cameras, operating them, maintaining them, looking at all the data, the cost of that in relationship to what they solve, there's just, it's totally out of proportion. It's like, you know.
Yeah. If you put 10,000 extra police on the street instead of,
yeah, well, exactly.
You know,
so,
a million
so,
cameras.
And so this is London, and the same in the Netherlands, the same in many other places where this has been, so again and again, we see that, you know, CCTV is mostly promoted by companies selling CCTV,
yeah,
which tells you a lot, I think.
The companies, you know, when you spend $300 million on a system, that comes with a really big lobbying group, you know.
So while there are, of course, some studies showing that CCTV is helping in preventing crimes or tracking down criminals, I think you never know if they are sincere, because of course some of these studies might be funded by that said industry. But nevertheless, I think that this is a technological question which might be solved in future. That is, if better and better cameras provide better and better records. Would that change your stance towards towards CCTV? Would you say that if yes, it is able to help track down a lot of criminals, would that change your opinion?
No. So here's the thing. Even if it is, okay, so a CCTV camera, assuming it actually works, it can do one thing. It can help track down a criminal. A CCTV camera can't give you directions to where the nearest ATM is. It can't, you know, help a little old lady cross the street, that kind of thing. You know, if we want personable, livable human cities, they need humans in them. And CCTV cameras are never going to get free. And it's always going to mean that, I mean, you know, let's assume for the minute that we can be generous and say that the police can be actually helpful in our cities, you know, that they don't have to just be a force for beating up hippies, you know. I think there's a lot of other ways to spend that money, and I don't see the tech, I mean, and honestly, if the technology got so good that it was suddenly actually really useful, like it could just recognize everybody's face, that's horrifying. Because if it really, really works to solve the problem, that also means that they can track anything else you might do just as easily. And we've seen time and time again that if you build a system that has the possibility of being abused, it is abused. You know, that the existence of that system creates the abuse. You know, I don't think there's anything to benefit from making it easier to abuse people. And I am perfectly happy to get mugged a few times to keep from, you know, having that complete, I mean, it's not worth the trade-off. You know, get rid of the guns on the streets so that you don't get shot when you get mugged. And okay, yeah, you lose your wallet. It sucks. Maybe you get punched a few times. It sucks. You still have a life. You still have rights.
It's actually breaking news that the new UK government is planning to undo most of the really radical surveillance crap. So the Conservatives and the UK Liberals are like undoing stuff that the Labour Party installed in the last 10 years.
It's what the Liberal Democrats are getting in exchange for getting rid of the rest of the welfare society.
Yep.
You win some, you lose some.
If CCTV is such a bad thing, why are you fighting fire with fire?
Because if you want to have a political demonstration in a modern city, you don't have the option of not appearing on camera. You are going to show up on that camera. And that's one of the reasons why installing more cameras of your own, it's not about creating privacy. You don't have the option of creating privacy. Like, forget it. In that case, it is actually dead. That system is already being abused to track you. But what you can do is get rid of the power imbalance. You know, I mean, I don't think, you know, like there's in fact, this weekend at Maker Faire in San Francisco, there's an anti-surveillance fashion show or a counter-surveillance fashion show. That kind of shit doesn't work in the real world. You know, you go to a demonstration at like G20 or G8 or something, you show up on camera, they know who you are. That's fine. It's not fine, it's horrible, but you can't do anything about it. So let's try to fix the power imbalance where you only show up on camera when the police aren't beating you up, and make sure that the police also show up on camera so that after the fact, you know, when you are in a country where it's like, oh yeah, they're actually really not supposed to be beating you up, you know, that's not what they're supposed to be there for when you're being completely nonviolent, that you can actually win that lawsuit because there is actually evidence. You know, and maybe it means that they know that, oh yeah, we're on camera too, and we don't get to choose when we show up on camera either, so maybe they don't beat you up. I mean, it seems unlikely, but you know.
Clear.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the URL for the competition again is sldrc.com/projects/deployable. If it ends up getting a new URL, I'll post it on that site and forward it on. The site's pretty spare right now. There's a link to the slides there and like a couple of words I will probably be posting the scoring guidelines and a bit more information about what we're going, and probably at least some of the script for this talk sometime in the next week or two. It depends when I have time. So, any more questions?
Some time ago, I have seen a map. I think it was New York.
Yeah.
A map of the cameras.
Yep.
Was the ACLU that?
Yeah.
And do you know how did they create that map? Because there's also the issue of you have to go there, look, and catalog, and you are seen by the camera. You are cataloging.
Yep.
So how did they do that?
A lot of people walking around. The map was from like 2002. And it actually, so one of the things that they had as a feature of that map, you could plot a route that was the least surveilled route between two points. There are none anymore in Manhattan. You walk down any block and you're on four cameras.
Are there other projects similar to this one?
I don't know about all the details. I know there's like Copwatch out of Berkeley that spawned things in other places where they're like, you know, specifically going around with video cameras, shooting cops to... You know, basically any time they see a police officer doing anything, I think they may actually just have people following all the beat cops with video cameras now. But I don't know of all the details. You know, there is definitely a lot of work in this. One of the things to look at is, it's not in quite as current usage, the term SOUS surveillance, S-O-U-S, valence. Which was coined by Steve Mann out of the University of Toronto when he was going around with his wearable camera, kind of, you know, recording the locations of video cameras. So there are a few projects out there. It's a big problem, you know, and I mean, that's part of the problem is when you have one camera for every two people living in London, finding them all is a huge expense. I mean, I think it serves a useful pedagogical function for people to realize just how many cameras they interact with. But I don't know how useful it is in an actual tactical function versus, you know, doing FOIA requests or whatever about those surveillance systems, that kind of thing. You know, I mean, maybe not all the cameras, but at least maybe not all the private cameras, but at least the public cameras there's a map of. You know, you should be able to get at that map. You paid for them. So...